Accession number 29955, Reel 1.
Aynard, Reel 1. And yes, could you tell me please when you were born and where you were born?
I was born on the 10th of January 1922 in Gloucestershire at a house called Cumend. And my mother came from Gloucestershire, but my father, needless to say, with a name like Llewellyn, came from Wales. And I grew up between the two, really. What next?
Did your father serve in the First World War?
Yes, he did. Yes. He served under Allenby in the desert. And somewhere or other, the most fantastic photographs. He was his intelligence officer. And so they exist somewhere. My half-brother will have those.
Did he talk about that time?
Yes, endlessly. We got bored stiff with it.
Did he survive in one piece?
Yes. He wasn't... He'd gone to stop a mountain fire when he was quite young, barely grown up. And he'd... in some way the fire had blazed up and he'd stepped backward over the back of a quarry and broken his back, which in those days was fatal to you, really. And he was supposed never to walk again. And but he had, I must say, my father had great guts, and he was supposed to always lie in a bed, but he used to in some way get himself out of this and crawl across the room until eventually he managed to stand up again and went on from there. He was often in a lot of pain from his back, but he was all right other than that. Quite a tough old boy.
What did he do after the war?
Nothing very much. That was his downfall, really. He was really rather an old-fashioned thing, vice nowadays. He was a spendthrift, and he used to get through an enormous amount of money. I think because of his broken back, he'd perhaps been a bit spoiled as a young man. And whatever he wanted, he bought. And he had a great mania for houses, and he used to buy houses and do them up, enormous expense, and then sell it at a loss and move on to another. And he got through quite a fortune, and we went from rather palmy days to not very palmy days, I'm trying to say. Well, this has come off. What have I done? Right.
Could you tell me where you were educated when you went to school?
Ah, my education was very peculiar. In fact, I didn't really have much for an education. When we were quite young, we moved to Switzerland because in those days the Swiss franc was in our favour tremendously, quite the reverse of today, and you could live in Switzerland exceedingly cheaply. And as the family funds had sunk to nothing, we moved to Switzerland and lived there. And I was about five then, I think. And I went to a Swiss school, sort of, with my sister, who was 5 years older than me. But we went to this school, but being typically English children, we were the only two children that spoke English, but there were two American children there too, and my sister and I arranged that we should play a special game which the Swiss children wanted to play too, and we said, you can play with us if you speak English. And so they agreed to do this. Consequently, we never learnt very good French, and they learnt very good English. It was a sort of typically insular English outlook. that was my first schooling. And when we came back to England, I went to do lessons with a child who lived in the about a couple of miles away, I suppose. And I was taken there by car in the morning, dropped off there, but I had to walk home at night 2 miles, and I was quite little, which I did all on my own. One wouldn't dare do that in this day and age, would we? And then from there, I went to a school run by a French woman in Newbury. We were living in Berkshire at that time, because we'd moved there. My father had been at... And the reason we moved to Berkshire was my father had been at Winchester, and my brother was supposed to go there, but he had double pneumonia as a little boy and nearly died. He was very delicate, and consequently his education had got very behind, and he didn't pass the entrance exam to get in. And my father went to his old tutor at Winchester to say what to do with this boy, and the tutor had become headmaster of Bradfield, and so my brother went there, and at the same time my father's fortunes had come to nothing, he got a job as bursar there. It didn't last very long, because I think he spent such a lot of money on the college that they didn't think he was a very good bursar, and so he wasn't really keeping their finances very well either. So that came to an end. Then we went to Switzerland. But we returned to this Berkshire house which we'd had, and I went to a school in Newbury run by a French woman, and awful old brute she was, horrible to us, we were miserable there. And after that, my brother was killed in an air crash. He'd joined the Air Force, and he was killed when he was 21, and I think the family generally, what with my mother being ill, left in Switzerland because that was better for her illness. The heir to the family had been killed, and one thing and another. I was sort of scooped up by an uncle and did lessons with a governess with his daughter. And I don't think we learnt very much, because we weren't very nice to the governess. We didn't like her very much. And after that, I went to Westonbirt, which is a public school in Gloucestershire, where I was in great difficulty because, of course, my education simply hadn't kept up with it. At one time, when we returned from Switzerland, for months on end, my father had taken on my education, but it consisted of learning the old father, what was it, Lewis Carroll thing about the walrus and the whatever. by heart, and bits of Milton, strangely. It was a strange mixture that he put me in for. And some very peculiar arithmetic problems. Something about a hen and a half laid an egg and a half in a year and a half, so, or in a month and a half, so how many eggs in a year, or something like that. It was a nightmare, quite frankly, and I didn't get very far with that. So when I arrived at Westonbirt, I was way behind everybody else. And it was quite a job to keep up. I was all right on the whole on with the English mistress and the history mistress, because my father rather liked history. They finally gave me up on Latin. They said it simply was no good. And as I think I said at lunch, the French had been got out of me by the governess I'd shared with my cousin. And so really I was very poorly educated on the whole.
Were you still at Westonbirt?
Yes.
When war broke out, were you there?
No, I'd gone because there was a very famous headmistress, a marvellous woman, I must say. By that time my family had broken up, and my sisters were grown up, really, or nearly grown up, and so she'd very much taken me under her wing, and she'd gone to Cheltenham Ladies' College, and so I left Westonbirt and went to learn first of all domestic science, which was the great thing to do in those days, and then war broke out, and I learned shorthand and typing rather badly there, and that was brought us up to 39. So next question.
On the 3rd of September 1930, did you listen to the broadcast?
I was staying with my granny, and we'd been to church. She was a great churchgoer, and she even had family prayers before breakfast, which used to floor most of her grandchildren, who didn't like getting up early anyway, and to be faced with family prayers before they could have their breakfast was one too many. But anyway, Gran and I had gone off to church in a wonderful car, thinking back on it. It had, in those days you had a chauffeur, and he was dressed in breeches and gaiters and a sort of peaked cap, and he leapt down two steps from the car. You stepped up two steps to get into it, and then drove at a very slow pace, and off we went to church. And when we got back, he had a very ancient wireless, as we call them in those days, and we leant over this and heard Chamberlain announcing that we were now at war. So that's how I heard of it. And Gran, who had turned the house into a convalescent home for First World War soldiers, was a splendid woman, really. And I remember we went up after listening to this to the box room, and we took out a whole lot of black curtains to hang up over the windows, and because they said we must have no light showing from now on at night because of the bombing, and we hung these, and there weren't enough to go round. And I was rather appalled about this, because they only went on the front windows and not on the back. And I said to Gran, this won't do at all. And she said, oh, it'll be quite all right. The warden won't bother to go round to the back, so we needn't bother about that. And it'll all settle down, she said, you'll find, in a day or two, and it'll all become thoroughly routine. She was into it again from her First World War experiences. So,
at that age, did it seem quite remote to you, the war, or were you very aware of...
Oh, no. In those days, it was so near. Memories were very... one was terrified of war from a very... from a child. I mean, I was born, after all, 4 years after the end of the war. But fear of war was in everybody's mind from childhood up. And people were terrified of another war starting again. And it was sort of ingrained in one, a horror and terror of war.
And in these early months, were you aware of, did you see much? Was there much?
No, nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. There was no bombing in Wales. And we got quite used to the back not being covered with black curtains. And then I went back and did a... nobody quite knew what to do with me because I'd left school and had been about to sort of... come out, as you did in those days, you know, you had a lot of parties and went to had fun, and I'd been much looking forward to this, and of course all that came to a grinding halt. And so I went to do a job as for a term to my old school. My old headmistress took me on to be a secretary because they had had to evacuate the school into a country house nearby, and I went to do that. So that was... And we did get bombed there, actually, quite by mistake. I think some German aircraft got lost and emptied its bomb things very near to us. We were all sort of... taking cover.
Was there much damage to
you? No, none at all. It was a one-off, I think. There was a long, long pause in the war, at the beginning of the war, when nothing really very much happened. And then the Blitz came a lot later, of course.
But in between that, in between your moving down to London, you met the Stirlings, is that right? Is it that time...
No, that was much later. That was after MI5. And
well, perhaps we should stick to the chronology. So you were at this time, 1940, I suppose. And then how did you come to be brought into?
Yes, my father had rejoined up again in the Air Force this time because because of my brother having been in it, and he was an intelligence officer. And by this time he'd remarried and had two more children, and my mother was still stuck ill in Switzerland, and I went with him first of all down to Cornwall, where there was no RAF station at St Evel. And then from there he was posted to Stranraer in Scotland, and I went up there flying boats, and they'd taken over the local hotel for us all to live in, and he worked from there. And I applied to join my middle sister, who was working in an office, first of all in London at Scrubs, which was taken over, Scrubs Prison, full of lice it was. And then it had moved to Blenheim. I had no idea it was MI5. I just applied to, because I wanted to join her. And I wasn't very fond of my stepmother, and my great idea was to get away. And there was a long pause. I had to send references and things, and I had no idea why they were taking so long, but of course one was being vetted. And eventually they took me on, and I went to Oxford, and we were billeted in Keble College, and it was then I realised that I'd joined MI5 and had to sign the Official Secrets Act and so on. We went every day in double-decker buses from Keble, which used to park outside Keble. We all climbed on, and we got pushed out at the top of the drive at Blenheim, because they had lovely elm trees at Blenheim in those days, long since gone with the elm tree disease. And the Duke thought that the buses would ruin his drive, which no doubt they would have. So we all had to walk down the long drive from the gates of Blenheim, getting soaked in the rain and so forth. Rather bolshy about it. And I worked there in a hut in the courtyard, a Nissen hut, for the naval section, till I wrote this thing that I've told you about, where I, being frightfully dyslexic, I typed a huge thing out for naval, it was spelled NAVEL, and they couldn't believe I hadn't done it on purpose. So I was in rather ill odour there, and I was relegated to the what they call the registry, where we vetted, we got files out for people who were being vetted. And that didn't suit my dyslexia either, because a lot of them were sort of Polish names and so forth, spelt in very complicated ways. And of course, if you're dyslexic, it's quite difficult to work this out. And so I wasn't very popular there either, and eventually they said no good to them, and off I went.
Can you remember much about the registry itself, what it looked
yes.
like, and what the setup there was?
Yes, it was in, I think, I've been Blenheim since, and I think it was in the library. The whole of the bottom, the Duke lived in just a wing, and the whole of the main part of the house was taken over by MI5, bedrooms and all, and my sister was working in a downstairs room, which it was said that Churchill had been born in, and she was quite good at it all, because she typed rather well and spelt rather well and all the things I couldn't do. So then I was moved up into one of the bedrooms, where we went through these interminable lists of, it was frightfully boring. Most of intelligence work is frightfully boring. It's people think it's all frightfully exciting, and spies and things and guns, and as you see it on the cinema, and it isn't like that at all. It's incredibly boring. It's terribly detailed investigation and tracing of names through this and that and the other, and it can be unbelievably boring. My job was, after the naval episode, they weren't inclined to give me a very nice job, so I did that. But I had a very good time in Oxford, because I was just that age group. undergraduates were there for a year then, mainly. And, of course, they were making the best of their time before they were called up. And we had a lot of fun. And I enjoyed that part of it very much indeed. We worked very hard, long hours. It seemed to take most part of an hour to get from Oxford to Blenheim. I don't know how. But buses must have been very slow in those days. So we started at 8 from there and got back about, I suppose, 6 or 7 sort of thing. And we had worked 6 days a week, one day off, not necessarily the weekend. And but we played very hard in the evenings, but nights, because we were, that was our only living time, really.
What was Keble like to be staying in? What was
oh,
it?
Terrible. Terrible. It was, in those days, I must go and ask whether I can go around it again, because I think now it was built, it was had been the clergyman's college, and I think it was taken over when they moved from Scrubs because of the Blitz, because they were very badly off the college financially, and so it suited the War Office to hire it off them, and suited the college to hire it to them. And it was built like a cloister with open passages all the way around the two courtyards, and they were open to the elements, and they had little cell-like rooms off it, a tiny little cupboard with a bed in it, and it wouldn't take much more. And then what had been the sitting room for the undergraduates, but in fact we were 2-to-1 cell-like thing, and there was no central heating, of course, or anything like that. We were allowed fires, and the old scouts, the chaps, I don't know whether at Edinburgh they have scouts, do they? The scout was the fellow who looked after your room and looked after you generally. You were assigned as an undergraduate a scout, and they were all old chaps who'd been there forever, wonderful people, and they never looked after anybody except these young men who'd been there before. However, they took us all on in the sort of splendid way those old bodies used to in those days. So they were soon hanging out our smalls to dry them and looking after us instead and bringing us coal and so on. But there was only one loo to each corridor, which was the side of a square, 2 stories high, one loo on each story. And there were 6 or 8 bathrooms in the clock tower across the courtyard. So if you wanted a bath, you had to walk across the courtyard in your dressing gown, slippers in the snow, and then queue for these baths, because everybody was after them. It was the only way you could get warm, for one thing. And I thought, to hell with this, and discovered there was an attic room above the baths, but it had no form of heating, no fireplace or anything. But I persuaded my scout, who was a dear friend by that time, got me all out of all sorts of scrapes, that I would prefer that, because I'd have it to myself. And I bought myself a 1-bar electric fire, but of course there was no power there either. So I used to plug this into the light's socket, and after half an hour or so, the whole of the college, that side of the college, was plunged in darkness. And my dear scout, with an enormous supply of fuse wire, would put the fuse back on again, light it up, and somehow the college authorities never discovered. So I was able to get my bath without going across the courtyard. But I was quite ill there. I had measles and one thing and another. But we all survived.